And it's May 22nd. Hold on a second. I need to want to be able to pull up a screen here for you. There's a few things I want to show you before we begin. Yes, okay, I got it now. It disappeared. I was off for a while. First thing I want to show you is this. Actually, hold on a second. Remember, just this is not relevant, but it is relevant to what we did in a previous semester. I showed you how these do-gooders want to get rid of these the sculptures, the anti-Semitic sculptures. And they tried this already last year, and the courts ruled that it could stay. This is an example of the Judenfrau, the like the Jews are suckling a pig, and it's a terrible thing. Oops, let me shut that. It's a obviously, but today it has no meaning. No one is offended by this. There's no one even going to church anymore in Germany, and no one would even know what this means. So the idea that you're going to take this away, this is the sort of thing that I show when I go on my trips and I point out. I mean, I think Vienna, they have the anti-Semitic stuff in Germany, obviously, in Prague on the Charles Bridge. And rather than take this stuff away, this should be there to show what the church was teaching. Well, although they were unsuccessful last year, they were successful in another place. That the German church is going to cover the anti-Semitic sculpture. It can't remove it because it's too difficult. It's like connected to, it would be, I guess they'd break it if they removed it. They said for structural reasons. So here's another image of that. And now you're not going to be able to see it. It's not even in the church. It's like in a building next to the church. So if we were there, we would go in and see it. And I think it's so important to see these things. And how am I supposed to do my trips and everything when you have all these do-gooders going out there and trying to cover up history? It's bad enough in this country. People are taking down Teddy Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. Now an important part of Jewish history is being removed so people can't see it. I can't tell you how annoyed all this gets me. Incidentally, I said that we don't go in the churches. I'll tell you something interesting that remember I raised the issue of you have churches in Spain that used to be shuls. So I wondered, well, why can't we go in there and see it? Just if someone came into your house, kicked you out, turned it into a church, you're going to say you can't go back into your house. So I told you that I raised this with Rabbi Yehuda Hanken. And he thought it was a good svara, but he didn't want to paskin. Well, there's another rabbi, a well-known Talmud Chacham. Many people listening would know who he is. He's bringing a trip, maybe that right now. And he had the same issue, and he spoke to a leading posek, and the leading posek said, Yesh tzad lahakel, there's room to permit. And he is taking his group inside this church, an active church, because it's a shul. And just because they came in and made it a church, so we haven't yet done that. And but I just thought that was interesting. Also, I saw in the news, come on, the news. Where is it? Here's an article from the Times from 1962 dealing with the Brother Daniel case. I thought you'd find this interesting because it mentions that the court ruled that Brother Daniel, well, here, the court found that Brother Daniel, a member of the Order of Our Lady of Mount Carmel in Haifa, was entitled to be considered a Jew under most rabbinical laws, but not under the law of return because it's a civil law. We spoke about this. Now, look what it says. This apparent paradox in the court's thinking was later challenged by the chief rabbi of Israel, Yitzhak Nissim. He said that, quote, a Jew who converts to another religion is no longer a Jew under rabbinical laws, except in certain instances where it is felt that a Jew might ostensibly have converted for reasons of expediency. That's the Rav's position. And I would love to see where he discusses this, Rav Nissim. But that's the Rav's position, as we saw. I want to thank Mark Smilowitz. for emailing me. And I think Rabbi Kelman is going to be happy to hear this because Rabbi Mark Smilowitz was listening to the class, number 10, I think it is, yeah, number 10. And he heard Rabbi Kelman mention, first I gave the idea, the Rav's idea of machitza, how it's about loneliness, we're alone, we're supposed to be alone, we can approach God. That's the reason why men and women are separated, not necessarily machitza, but separated. And then I pointed out that this is not the normal way we understand it. And we discussed this a little, and Rabbi Kelman said, well, this idea that you're supposed to stand alone and... You know, what does that have to do with family? And the Rav said, I mean, Rabbi Kelman said that he recalls the Rav saying that you're not supposed to sit next to your parents for that very reason. And we would like to find out, we weren't sure whether that was practical, whether the Rav did this. Rabbi Mark Smilowitz has an article in the Last Tradition, and he was working with tapes of the Rav. And on page 169, he discusses the very notion we spoke about, that the idea that you're supposed to be lonely, prayer is about solitude. He says, we fight against the pew, family pew, because we want to isolate the individual from the family, at least for an hour or two, and to come to God alone. With no family, no wife, no children. And he cites the Rama. That is, the Rav cites the Rama, who says that parents can't kiss their children in the synagogue. That's halachi. That's because you're supposed to be focused on God, not supposed to display emotion. A lot of people ask the question, what about, especially Sfardim, after they get an aliyah, everyone comes over and kisses them. That's not what it's referring to. That's allowed. Children you're not supposed to kiss. Now, in the footnote, he points out that, in the tape, the Rav presents this halacha as a prohibition for father and son to sit next to each other in shul. Exactly what Rabbi Kelman said he heard, something that for us must sound strange, because the whole idea is that we dafka want children next to their parents. And then he says, during the question and answer period, someone pressed him about this. He mentioned the Ramah, claiming that Ramah says you should not embrace a child or even pat his child, even look at his child. I mean, to caress the child with a glance during prayer. So I would love to know if anyone from Boston could say, did the Rav sit with his son or not? Did he sit with his grandchildren? Because exactly what Rabbi Kelman thought he heard, we have the Rav on tape saying that father should not sit next to child, precisely because he has this whole notion that prayer is about solitude. And that's the whole idea of separation, men and women, not the sexual angle. That's secondary. It's the whole idea of solitude. And that's why, I mean, the whole question of, you know, the sexual angle, that doesn't explain. That explains why, let's say, single people can't, or I guess other women can't sit there with men. But what about husband and wife? Let's say you had a section, just husband and wife sit here, husband and wife sit there. For the Rav, it's still a problem, because prayer is about solitude. And husband is not even supposed to sit next to wife, also child. So thank you, Rabbi Mark Smilowitz, very much for that. I looked after the class last time. I happened to open up. I have a number of Sephardic Sidurim, and I really was incorrect in what I said, at least that they don't say Hallel with Rosh Chodesh, Hallel without a bracha. That is the case in Israel. And that's the case for a number of Sfaradim. But I'm looking in my various Sfaradic Sidurim, and there are indeed, in Chutz Laaretz, certain Sfaradic communities that do make a bracha on it. So you always have to be careful when you make a blanket statement. Part of the problem is Chacham Avadia Yosef has established these rules, and when he says Sfaradim don't make the bracha, he's saying that in his opinion they don't. And as far as I know, in Israel, no one does it. Even the Moroccans, I think, when they went to Israel, have fallen into line with this, although someone can correct me if I'm wrong. But it's more complicated, as is often the case, than Rav Avadia makes it out. I see I'm not going to be able to get to Rav Cook on ball playing, but I'll get to that maybe next class. I got the sources here. Let me put it aside. I do want to do one more thing. And that's more about cooking on Shabbos, because I got some great stuff sent to me. First, I looked online because I wanted to see if anyone talks about the Rav and heating up liquids. And there is. There's a site called Miodea. I just Googled it. And someone says as follows. Now, you say, why do I have to quote these sources? You can ask the family. I don't know. Often the family doesn't like to speak about these sorts of things. Maybe the practices they have are not accepted today. But if it's online, it's public information. He says, this is someone writing, I was told by an old friend of Atara Tversky, the daughter of the Rav, that she also used to heat up soups on Shabbos. I don't know if this means that she was following the practice of her father or her husband. He asks, does anyone have any knowledge of the Rav's ruling in this area? And someone replies with a presentation, a halachic presentation, why it's would be permitted to do it. That chicken soup, let's say, once it's cooked, it's already cooked. It's not like water that after you let it go back to room temperature, you heat it up again. He quotes an Egel Tal. The idea that the prohibition to put soup on a blech is based on cooking, it's not a separate prohibition. And then the Ran. So you can read all this. But thank you, Eli, for calling attention to Rav Schechter in his Shiurei HaRav Gaon Rav Soloveitchik on Shabbos. On page 208, he discusses this matter. And first he says, Yesh Kula Gedola. He cites the Kula Gedola of the, that's the Ran, which is cited in the Ramah. And then he says, but the Ramah holds that if you let it be cold completely, which would be the case, obviously, you put it in the fridge, then you can't put it back on. And he says that Nira Delesa, he says that there's another way of reading the Gemara, the sources, that that's not the case. And then he gets into the question, what about a davar lach, a marak soup? And he says, Yesh Le'ayin, are you allowed to do this if you stand in Yamarulav, if you stand there and make sure that it doesn't reach Yatzo Edispo? And he goes through all the reasons why it is permissible. But then he says, he's quoting the Rav apparently. He says, the Kashalatir. Despite this, he said it's difficult to permit. But maybe the Rav was saying this for the students in the Shir. He didn't want them to, but we know that the Rav's mother did it. We see now that Atara Tversky did it. The Rav, though, was careful. How do I know he's careful? Why do I say this? Because Steve sent me something. It's a good historical document from the time that the Rav was alive, because he's listed at the top here. Sabbath rules for caterers at Maimonides School. Here it is. Sabbath rules for caterers at Maimonides School. And he gives various rules, for example, that food and equipment cannot be brought to the school after sunset. Talks about how the flame must be covered with a metal covering before sunset, a blech. Then he says, quote, all the food that will be served warm must be on the stove covering before sunset. Then he said, following this, the food may be removed from the stove only after nightfall, Friday night. These may then be placed in a refrigerator. That's the heter we spoke about. But the Rav is not being exact here. It says here that you can only remove it after nightfall. But we know it's not after nightfall. It's Be'na Shmashos. So I think he's just saying this to be more careful, to make sure that they don't remove it too soon. Number six, it says, any solid foods, not liquid foods or gravy, may be removed from the refrigerator and placed on the stone covering, provided that points three and four were attended to. What we said, that's before what I mentioned, that it has to be on the stove before sunset, and it has to be taken off, Be'na Shmashos or after nightfall. Notice that he says here, no liquids. So you see that despite what the Rav's private practice might have been, when it came to for the tzibur, he was careful and he didn't permit that. Whether that's because that's more of a kula, or whether because he's afraid that the people are not going to be careful and it's going to reach Yad Soledispo, the liquid, I'm not sure, but that's what he says. He, in Maimonides, you weren't allowed to take out the liquid. Now, notice he only mentions about putting it on a blech, but I told you that the halacha, he held the same thing about an oven. And oven does create other issues, but I saw that Rav Yitzchak Yosef and Yalkut Yosef holds that the way we have with our ovens, he holds that an oven's no different than a stove, a blech. You could take it just like you can the machzer, the hoser it, put it on a blech. You could put it in an you could put it in an oven. He holds, of course, Ravitz like Yosef, that you have to have all the restrictions about chazar holding it, etc. But the point, the important point I'm mentioning is that he has this idea that an oven is no different than the stove top, you know, with the blech. So that would be the same for, you know, the Rav also held about the oven the same thing. So thank you all for mentioning this to me, mentioning what you sent me. And now we pick up very interesting things. And I see already some good comments. I'll get to them at the end. Responding to my question about from those who, I guess, davened with the Rav and the family was there. But now I'm introducing you to, Meir Kahan. Just came out of Meir Kahan by Shaul Magid. If you leave aside Shaul Magid's politics for a minute, very, very much on the left, which comes through in the book, I have to say that the book is quite an interesting read. He puts Kahana in the context of the 1960s and the Black Power movement and liberalism versus radicalism. It's quite an interesting read. I don't think I don't want to go through who Meir Kahana was. The young people might not know that much about him, but you could look it up. People my age and older obviously know who Meir Kahana was. He moves to Israel in 1971, sort of giving up on America. He opened up in Israel something he called the Museum of the Potential Holocaust, and the idea was that there's going to be a Holocaust coming very soon in America. It was full of all the pictures of the anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic movements in America, the Klan. It's hard to imagine that Meir Kahana really believed this, that the Holocaust was right around the corner. But he did what he did in America. He brought Soviet Jewry, made it an helped make it an important issue, the JDL. A lot to say about him. He goes to Israel. Then he gets into politics. His party is banned from running. They thought he was going to get 10 seats. That was the polls. He was elected to Knesset. Then they banned him, called it a racist party. And then he's assassinated. He actually, in America, in 1990, he's assassinated. As 1990, November, as I recall. Let me get the exact date. This is important for a minute. I'll tell you why it's important. Yes, he's assassinated in New York, November of 1990. So why do I say this is of importance, of interest? Well, let me show you something here. Let me get back here. The last public talk he gave before he was assassinated. He did then speak the night he was assassinated, he spoke. But aside from that, and I don't know if that was a public talk for anyone, but leaving that aside, his last public talk before he was assassinated was on October 31, 1990, and he was assassinated November 5th. Now, this was at Brandeis University. I spoke about this in the past in the classes on my latest book, but for those who weren't with us, just let me briefly summarize it. Meir Kahana loved coming to Brandeis because Brandeis, in his eyes, was the classic example of American assimilation. Liberal Jews who were interested in every progressive and liberal cause under the sun, but not about Jewish values. That is, Kahana would say Jewish values in quotes. So going to Brandeis was like going into the lion's den. So he came to Brandeis on October 31st, 1990. He gave, I encourage everyone to watch it. It's an hour and a half talk. It's almost all of it. It's like the last couple minutes. It's not included. In there, you see, incidentally, Rabbi Mark Gopin from the Gopin family getting up and screaming at him. It's quite interesting. And anyone who's never heard Meir Kahana from the younger generation, you get him in his full glory here, what he believed and everything, his sense of humor and his sharpness. You get it right here. If you're only going to watch one video, in fact, I would say you can watch this video. He's not only speaking to Jews, he's speaking to non-Jews. Look who put it online. I put the video online, as you can see, M. Shapiro. I have another YouTube account, Mark Shapiro. So I'm not a Kahanist by any means. Those who've been listening know that. However, I'm also not a believer in censorship. And I think it's important to put it on. And it was a public event. And some people are no doubt very upset. How could I give him publicity? How could I spread it? Him? That's not my way. We put it up there, let everyone listen to it. And now, granted, now people watch and they say, wow, he was right. I'm stunned how right he was. So you have, but the point, that's not my concern. I also put up another video of his where he debated with Rabbi Albert Axelrod at Brandeis 5 years before. Give credit to Rabbi Axelrod for debating with him. And, you can watch that debate as well. And for those who are upset with me putting it up, maybe this will remove some of your being upset. On the same channel, I put up this tape. I found on YU Torah, Yiddish talk of the Rav, the role of the rabbi, and it's impossible to hear. So I found online a way that you can take an audio and you can increase it. And now it's a beautiful sound. Just go to YouTube and plug in Soloveitchik, role of the rabbi. That's a famous picture here. That's Rav Schechter right there. And now you can hear it perfectly. How'd I get the picture? I'm hardly tech savvy. I looked online and it explained to me how you can put a YouTube video up with a picture. And it turned out perfectly. Okay, so getting back to the story. I think this is what we need. Ah, yes, okay. So I'm involved with this blog called The Sfarim Blog, and there's an author named Jacob Sasson, and first of all, you have archives in Israel. One of the greatest archives is the Rav Herzog archive. I went through the Rav Herzog archive when it was in Heichal Shlomo, and I found all sorts of important material. I published Rav Herzog's letter dealing with the Zohar as an appendix to my essay on Is There an Obligation to Believe the Zohar is Written by Rashbi? I have all sorts of other stuff from Rav Herzog, not all of which has been put online, and I'm going to be publishing another letter from Rav Herzog. So I was sitting on this stuff, and it's really great stuff. I go back to Heichal Shlomo about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, because every time I went to Israel, I went to Heichal Shlomo to look through archives, and they told me that the stuff's not here. It's been sent away for digitizing. Who knows how long that's going to take? I thought it might be 20 years. But fortunately, Israel's bureaucracy, at least in this respect, is quite good, and they're putting things on. There's millions of documents online now, and they put, within a couple years, they put on hundreds of files of Rav Herzog. Okay, so now it's available for anyone who wants to look at it, although fortunately, some of the stuff I have hasn't been put on. I have the material, it hasn't been put on. So Jacob Sasson, he started going through it, and he published some nice pieces, two pieces on the Sfarim blog, two posts with really interesting stuff I knew about, and maybe I would have done it one day, but I never got around to it. And then he came out, he hit the jackpot. I never would have found this. I also went through the archives of Yaakov Herzog. That's where I found the transcript of the talk of Yaakov Weinberg and Yaakov Herzog, and also the audio, which now is also online. However, Jacob went on, he also went through the Chaim Herzog archives, which I never would have thought of it, because Chaim Herzog, he wasn't a religious Jew. What connection does he have to the things I'm interested in? Yaakov Herzog, his archive is full of letters of rabbis and things that are of interest to me. And Jacob hit the jackpot. Let me show you what he hit. This is taking us back to 2018. Like it says here, four comments. There were hundreds of comments. They redid the blog under a new format, and all the old comments were lost. So, unfortunately. So what did he find? One of the things he found was as follows. This letter. Here, you can see it. On Yeshiva University stationery. A letter from the Rav to Meir Kahana. And, this was heard around the world. This we knew. I mean, this was dynamite. That to have no one knew about this letter, And not only did no one know about it, wait till you see what the Rav said in the letter. Again, this when this appeared, people were talking about it all over the world. I believe this is the most popular post ever on the Sfarim blog in terms of readership, because it was sent out, well, either this or my attack on Art Scroll for censoring the Rashbam, the Mikros Gedolos, one of the two. But this reached people who are not interested in Sfarim. It even reaches, as we'll see, Yitzhak Herzog, Nasi HaMedina, at present, as I'll show you. But so here you have this on Yeshiva University stationery, or is it Yeshiva University stationery? That's going to be one of the interesting points. This is not Yeshiva University stationery. This is internal document, like internal stationery. So let me tell you what this letter says. And then we'll see why the conclusion is, which I totally share, that this is a forgery. It begins, Be'ezrat Shor Yisrael v'Goalo. Okay, Tu B'Av, Parshas Ekev, so we're talking summertime, Tavshin Mem Dalet, 1984. It's addressed to the Nasi, Chaim Herzog, son of my friend, the great Gaon, or Yitzhak Isaac Herzog. He says as follows: you certainly know the great ties, the close ties between me and your father, and with the entire, he says, u'emesim b'kol ha'mishpacha, it should say mikol ha'mishpacha. This is part of the problem. There's some, I don't know, it's called grammatical or other problems that you wonder if the Rav could have written this. And then he says, you, Chaim Herzog, you are named, Shem Kvodo is named after my grandfather. And that's true. Chaim Herzog was born just a few months after Reb Chaim died, and he's named after him. And Chaim Herzog's brother, the other son of Chief Rabbi Herzog, was named Yaakov David Herzog, named after the Ritzbaz, Yaakov David Wolofsky. It's quite ironic because Yaakov David Wolofsky was the great opponent of Reb Chaim's method of learning, and no love lost. There's no love lost between Riskers and the Ritzbaz. The Ritzbaz attacks Reb Chaim in introduction to one of his Sfarim. And I have Edut Ne'emana that there's a student in the 1950s, early 50s, who quoted the Ritzbaz, and the Rav went crazy. Don't ever quote him again. And when the student mentioned it, this is what the Rav said. I don't know if I'm supposed to quote it, but this is what he said. He said, there are some Gedolim who are always right. There are some Gedolim who are sometimes right. And there's some Gedolim who are never right. The Ritzbaz was never right. And so the Rav went crazy about, so it's just ironic that in Rav Herzog's family, you have Rav Chaim and the Ritzbaz. The Ritzbaz taught that Rav Chaim destroyed Torah learning with his new approach to learning. If you want to see it, well, he did classes on this, but go check out the introduction to his Nimuke Ritzbaz, where he doesn't mention Rav Chaim by name. He talks about the certain Rosh Yeshiva. So then he goes on, I want to speak about, I'm not writing about this. He says to President Herzog, I understand that you want to, you know, your office, you're going to lead it in with Chochmah, and that you have all sorts of considerations you have to take into account. But the Rav says that something sticks in my throat, something, I have a problem. I don't understand why. You know, as the president, when you have a new government, you invite all the you invite the people to the different members of Knesset to meet with you. He says, why did you have to invite the representatives of the he says Nitzige Araf, Miflaga Nitzige Arafat. Why do you have to invite Arafat's people, namely the left wing, the Arab parties, whichever party he's referring to? And never, and you did that, and had then the murderers, you know, supposedly, and yet you refuse to invite Rabbi Meir Kahana Nero Yair. So, he refers to him positively, he says that, you should know, President Herzog, I'm not one who's impressed by, you know, outside things, not, if it's of Gaiva or Koach, and you know that I don't speak on politics only when I speak for the Mizrahi, which I have a strong connection to, because it is following its historic path of keeping all the Jewish people together, etc. He says, but now I must express myself to you very openly, as always, as clearly as I can, that Rav Meir Kahana, who's a Ketzas Talmud Chacham, he's a little bit of a Talmud Chacham, even though he has some craziness to him. He's a Jew who's a Yirei Shamayim. He fights for Torah and Kavod Shem Shamayim and the honor of Israel. He cannot be compared to the worst among those who throw off Torah and are enemies of Israel. And I say to you, I'm saying this to you so you don't hear my opinion from others, like students of mine, and you'll doubt whether I said it. He says, if you listen to my opinion, you should invite now Kahana, because you're able to, moderate him. He has a lot of Mesiras Nefesh. You can moderate him. And I also say to you that it'll be a Kiddush Hashem. That you now then he says something else. He says, I'm also gonna say to you, I'm taking the permission to say to you that it'll be a great Kiddush Hashem if you are careful when you're in public to be Mekayim Mitzvos. Chaim Herzog comes from a religious family, went to Yeshivas Chevron. He wasn't an Orthodox Jew. He sent his Yitzhak Herzog, I believe, went to Ramaz. He was a traditional Jew, but he wasn't a complete Shomer Shomer Mitzvos. So he says, you should be careful when you're in public to be observant. In this, you'll be able to unite the people and you'll give nachas to your parents and your grandparents who came from the Divrei Malkiel. He's descended from the Divrei Malkiel. Why the Rav would ever cite the Divrei Malkiel, who's just it's a halachic authority, but what is he to mention of different Malkiel? He says, is there also a possibility that your sons and daughters will also go in the path of Torah and Mitzvos? Apparently, I don't know. It's not for me to speak. I don't know if President Herzog, the current President Herzog, is a Shomer Shabbos or not. I don't know. But he says, is it possible that they will also do that? These those who know the great kedusha of your father, who had such great talents and abilities, and also his great emuna in Zionism. It doesn't really end the sentence here, but he says hamivinim. I think he's just saying the people who know understand his greatness. Then he goes on that God should, grant good things for you, etc. Okay, he signs his name, Yosef Dov ben La'aba Mara, Rabbi Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, Ish Boston, from men of Boston. Where did copies of this go to? He says to Norman Lamb, Yosef Bor. Yosef Bor was a leading Mizrahi figure in Knesset, and Harav. What's this? Harav Shitrick? Shetrick? Shetrick? It's actually Harav Strick. Michael Strick. When I went to BMT, he was head of the YU Center in Israel. Okay, so this comes out, and the whole world is shaking that because why is it shaking? Because everyone knows the Rav's view of Kahana before this. The Rav was very opposed to Kahana. He thought he was a Chilul Hashem. He thought he was. He's not in, and Jews have to be edel. They have to be dignified. And he's the opposite of being dignified. And he expressed his opinion on numerous occasions that this is not the way that a Jew should conduct himself. And here, the change of opinion. So, okay, so some people said, well, this is sort of at the end where the Rav was. He only gave shiur for another year, and he was very weak. Maybe people imposed on him, or maybe someone wrote it up and got him to sign it. Or others said, "Well, he's entitled to change his mind." Notice he's not agreeing with Kahana. He's simply saying that you have to show him respect. Bring him in, and it's important. But it's still, a respectful letter. More respect than Rav Meir Kahana would have given to the Rav. Because he thought that people like the Rav were simply leading the Jewish people astray with their moderate attitude. My father, when I went to Israel once with my family in 1981, let's see, 81, I believe it was. So I was a young ninth grader, and after ninth grade in high school, we saw signs up in Jerusalem at the Khan had his museum, the Museum of Potential Holocaust. He spoke in English once a week. So my father and I went to it. And then afterwards, my father made an appointment to speak to him, to interview him. And he came back and had a whole interview with him. And he was thinking of doing an article on it and never wrote an article. But he asked him, you know, what about the great rabbis? Because after all, Orthodox Jews were Meir Kahana from the Mir, big black yarmulke. You know, what's aren't you supposed to follow the Gedolim? When I was in high school, one of my rabbis said, the problem with Kahana, he didn't say the problem with Kahana is any of his ideas. That's what he didn't say that. He said, the problem with Kahana is he doesn't listen to the Gedolim. So Kahana's answer to my father was that basically the rabbis don't get it. That his answer was that if you want to know how to understand the sugya, you go to the rabbis. You want to know if it's muktzah, you go to the rabbis. But in terms of leading the Jewish people, they don't get it. They're living like they're still in Warsaw or something like that. That was his approach. Okay, so this appears in what did we say it was? I think we said it was February, yes, June of 2018. Okay. In February of 2019, so let's say 7 months later, and I didn't know about this. Actually, no, I did. I did know when this was going to, but I didn't. I had no input. I'm not one of the editors. I'm just so they'll send me things to read sometimes to see if it should go up. And I after Eliezer Brot, I have the most posts, so I'm in. I've got some money for the blog, but it's not my blog post. In my latest post, you'll see someone claimed my response to someone. He says it's my blog. It's not my blog. I don't own it. There's nothing. I just write for it. Correction and apology for an earlier post. A few months later, we featured a fascinating two-part post about newly discovered documents from a Fritzog's archive. And then it says one of them was a letter to about Kahana, written to President Herzog by the Rav in the summer of 84, which was surprisingly supportive of Kahana. A careful examination of the document by the family of Soloveitchik reached the opposite conclusion. This letter is a crude forgery. And then it says that their conclusion was not derived because they disagree with the opinions. But no, it was because characteristics in the letter. And that's it. That's we apologize to our readers for posting and disseminating this false piece of information. Well, lots of comments, and not everyone accepted it. A lot of people thought that this was, you know, they're trying to be revisionist here. Someone in the comments points out, what would happen if you found a letter from a Rosh Yeshiva, Haredi Rosh Yeshiva, who privately said that it's important to get a secular education. And then people started saying it's a forgery. All you modern Orthodox people would be outraged. Of course, it's not a forgery. They're just trying to rewrite history. So the arguments and the discussions began. This led almost a year later, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, Rosh Yeshiva of Har Etzion, felt that he had to respond. As it says, it was recently brought to my attention that various readers of Svarimbach have expressed skepticism regarding the determination that this letter was a forgery. So I'm going to summarize for you his points. I think they're entirely conclusive. I know the Kahanists, or some of them, refuse to accept it, but it's so obvious to me that it's a forgery. I didn't really think about it beforehand. I assume that maybe someone wrote it for the Rav. But it's so clear now. So let me just summarize for you what he says. And he says, you know, enough with all the conspiracy theories. Let's present the evidence. Later, he says that even if you don't accept every single piece, when you put it together, it's clearly a crude forgery. And the first point, and this is like the only point that I noted, was the signature of the Rav. Look at the signature here. And it's written, Yosef Dov. The Rav never wrote this way. He always wrote it with a vav. Okay, so they're going to say, well, he didn't type it up. Someone else typed it up. But look at the signature. The signature is also Dalet Vet. Find another letter, Ramosha Lechazin says, where the Rav does not spell his name, Dalet Vavet. You won't be able to find it. Second of all, the signature is clearly not the Rav. We have signatures from the Rav the same time as this. This is not the Rav's signature. So that's important. Then he goes on. Hold on. He says, look where it says here. Abba Mara. That's not, it's Abba Mari, not Abba Mari, Mara. And look how he signs. Nowhere does, in all the letters we have of the Rav, he only signs his name like Ben Hagona Chassid, Ramosha Soloveitch. He never signs it Abba Mara. Amara's wrong. He never signs Abba Mari. Where did the forger get this idea, Abba Mari? Because the Rav has a volume, two volumes, Shirim Lezecher Abba Mari. So the forger knew these volumes that the Rav wrote, Chidushim of the Father, in Chidushim, which he mentions, in case he gave a Yotzei year every year. So he says, Zecher Abba Mari, but he never wrote a letter this way. And furthermore, it says, look how he signs his name. Oh, incidentally, and when he wrote to people, we already read this whole semester, we've been reading letters, he wrote to political figures. He never signs it. He just signs it, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. He never signs it, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik Ben Hagon or something. Those are rabbinic type of letters, not the political figures. Then Moshe Soloveitchik points out, and he gives examples. You can read this. This is the best one, though. He says, look at this here. He says, Ish Boston. Nowhere does the Rav ever sign his name. Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, East Boston. Listen to Moshe Lichtenstein. He was not Paul Revere, and apparently did not consider Ish Boston to be a defining characteristic. In other words, there's no letters ever where he signs off Ish Boston. There wasn't. Then he continues. He says, well, look, this is not stationary even. The Rav, every time, every one of his letters, he never writes letters on YU stationery. Kal vachomer, this isn't YU stationery. All the letters we have of the Rav, and we have many, many letters, they're all on his own stationery. And this is, as I said, this someone working in YU or had access to it got a hold of the inter-office stationery and typed this up. No doubt about that. Then he goes on, he talks about the signature, and signatures are important. He speaks about signatures, you have Kiyum Shtaros. So he gives example of that. We don't need to get into that. You can see that. He talks about the stationery. What's the Rav doing copying? Okay, you say copies Dr. Lamb, Yosef Bor. Well, copy Michael Strick at YU. What's Michael Strick have to do with anything? My Rabbi Lichtenstein says he didn't even know who Michael Strick was. He's someone who worked in the office in Israel and YU. It's the whole thing makes no sense. And then he, this is the weakest, I think, but you don't need this. He says he never signed Ezra Tzuri Shalvagolo, which is true. He didn't sign it. But then Rav Lichtenstein goes into the point that the Rav would never use this phrase because the Rav, as he says, was opposed to three elements of religious Zionism that he encountered in it with Israeli religious Zionism. The first was that Jewish nationalism and its political expression are the highest religious value. The second was the perspective that viewed the establishment of the state as highly significant stages in the redemption. He called this, he thought that this was excessive value to the point of glorification and deification, and he viewed it as delusional. So I don't know, since you can't you still say Tzuri Shalvagolo, even if you don't believe in messianic type Zionism? But he thinks not. He thinks the Rav would never sign a letter, the Ezra, you say Ezra Hashem or something, but not Tzuri Shalvagolo. I find that a little weak. Look, the Rav never did, but I don't think you can use that expression and have it in an eschatological sense. In the messianic sense, doesn't have to mean that you're in the present. He's not saying that, Medina Sisro, Reishis Michas Kulaseinu or anything. And he goes on and he was very distant from historical appraisal that saw the Gula as imminent. So anyone who's interested in the Rav's view about Zionism, you can read Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. The Rav was afraid, was he says, was objected to changes in liturgical and halachic settings. That's why he didn't like the term Israel. He referred to Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein says that even wearing a white shirt on Shabbos rather than a suit would annoy him because he saw it as an anti-Gullet sentiment. I can attest firsthand. I spent time with my grandfather as a wide-eyed 17-year-old youth. He says, I often expressed my Zionism in front of the Rav, and he would get angry at me, and or annoyed with me, I should say. Okay, so this is a side point, though, because I think if you say Ezra Sori Yisrael v'Goalo, that doesn't really affect Zionism per se. But then he goes on that the Rav would never write to a person like Herzog and criticize his level of observance, to speak about his children. Anyone who knows the Rav, he wouldn't, especially in an important letter like this, where he's asking Herzog to do something, he wouldn't say to him, it would be better if you publicly would be a Shomer Shabbos, and I hope your children are a Shomer Shabbos. He just continues other things. He says that the Rav shared Rav Herzog's view. He cited something from Rav Herzog that Jews should never be involved in acts of revenge. Even if the Arabs do something, we don't murder, we don't shed the blood of innocent. And he goes on explaining that. The funny thing is that this is what's interesting as well, is that Herzog, he gets the letter, and what does he do? He sends a reply to the Rav. And here's the reply of the letter. Did the Rav ever get this reply? We don't know. Maybe the Rav got it. He didn't know what he's talking about. Maybe it was intercepted. Someone has speculated that there's people who had access to the Rav's mail. But this is what Chaim Herzog says to the Rav. With a copy going to Borg. He says, I received your letter. This is in the Herzog archives. And he says, I thought long and hard before I decided not to invite Kahana. And let me explain to you why. But he addresses Rav Soloveitchik as Maran, Rav Yosef Dov, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, Shlita, Rosh Hashiva, Yeshiva University. He says that Kahana is saying terrible things about the Arabs, who are 17% of our citizens, the majority of whom, Rubam Kukulam, the overall majority of whom, observe all laws. They're not terrorists or anything like that. And we, Refertzuk says, according to my simple knowledge, we're obligated to treat them properly in accordance as Gerim and Toshavim, according to the laws of the Torah. He says, my father expanded on this in an article, which he did. Refertzuk wrote an article on how to treat the Miyutim, the minority communities in Israel. And he followed this path of Rav Kook on this. So how could he... How could I invite Kahana when what he says is pasul, not just mibchina enoshit, from a humanitarian and moral perspective, but from a Jewish perspective? So I couldn't do that. Second of all, what Kahana says could literally lead to issues of pikuach nefesh. You have Jews who live in the Arab world. Not to mention the fact, I would add, that this isn't, you don't have to live in the Arab world. You can, this can encourage terrorism against Jews who live wherever they are. I think of all the attacks in France and in America, about England also, obviously in Israel, of people who were practicing jihad. He says that when I was considering whether to invite him, Tahana, before I even made my decision, threatened me that if I don't invite him, he's going to come with force, break into the house of the Nasi. He says, I can, be mochel on my personal kavod. I can't be mochel on the kavod of the presidency of Israel. And he says, nevertheless, even though I said I will not invite Kahana, I left open a door for him to do tshuva. And I said that if he retracts all of his statements and threats, I will reconsider my opinion. He says, so I hope that I've clarified to you my position. And he says that bringing his gears to the Ankusa as a youth, I guess, at her scholar, that we should fulfill what it says, you know, all your children will be learned of God, Rav Shalom Banayach, et cetera, et cetera. And I give you a bless you for the new year. I don't think there's any question. No question in my mind whatsoever. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is absolutely correct. It's a forgery. I found online an article in Makor Rishon. Did Rav Soloveitchik defend Kahana? And this is after Rav Moshe Lichtenstein. So here you have quotes from Rabbi Rakefet, from Michal Ben Ari, who's a Kahanist, who says he thinks Rav Soloveitchik wrote it. What does he know? What does Michal Ben Ari know? What is he? But then what I think is interesting, they quote Rav Katriel Brander, that's Kenny Brander, that who says the Rabbi Soloveitchik never would have used these this stationery. He didn't write the letters, you know, from the Yeshiva University stationery. And then he quotes President Herzog. He quotes Nachman Kahana, the author of the Mei Menuchos on Tosos, the brother of Meir Kahana, who says, "I never heard this, and I'm certain it's forged." He says that it's not realistic, reasonable that Rav Soloveitchik would write this way to Kahana. He says that you know, me and my brother, we learned together in Chavrusa, but I came to Israel before him, and he changed. He wasn't the same Yeshiva Bachur I knew, or maybe I changed. So the brother says that, and the brother, by the way, is not some Haredi. He lives in the old city. I mean, he's not. He has right-wing views. He used to teach at BMT when I was there, but he does not. He thinks it's a forgery. And then finally, they quote Yitzhak Herzog, current president of the State of Israel, who at the time was the head of the Sochnut, that he just speaks about why my father, under no circumstances, could ever have invited Kahana, because his whole life was about opposition to racism and discrimination and things like that. So that is the letter, the so-called letter to Kahana, which I hope you find interesting. I think we can establish often you have documents that come out and there's debate about them. But then there reaches a point where you can establish either they're authentic or they're not authentic. Sometimes you'll conclude they are, and other times you're not. When the Dead Sea Scrolls came out, you had this eccentric genius in Philadelphia, Solomon Seitlin, who wrote tens and tens of articles with all sorts of brilliance arguing that they're a forgery. And of course, they're not a forgery. So his articles are still of antiquarian interest. And also, he'll point out things. He'll say, for instance, that such a word would never appear in the time, Second Temple times, but now we know that it would appear. So he calls our attention to some things. They did the carbon dating, so we know they are. But then you have examples of matters that were debated. At the time, it was realistic to assume that it was either authentic or a forgery, but then it's proven to be a forgery, and no one can look back at it anymore and take it seriously. Lots of examples. Josephus's reference to Jesus, since we mentioned Second Temple times, everyone knows today that's a forgery. There's all sorts of examples of documents. The Cherson archives, Chabad people will excuse me for saying that, the so-called phony letters from the Baal Shem Tov, the letters published by Chaim Bloch, Gedol Yisrael, letters of all the Gedolim against Zionism. I mean, everyone knows that certain things are forgeries. And this letter has to go down as a forgery. So
protocols.
When you write what?
The protocols of the Elders of
protocols
Zion.
Of Zion. I don't know if they ever were thought to be authentic. I mean, did anyone ever think the protocols of the Elders of Zion were authentic? Although Chaim Bloch, he's caused such problems in his books. He's citing things from Disraeli and all that. We know what's now forged, and yet people use his material. So I think when you write the history of the Rav, you will regard this as a complete forgery, no questions about it. Some troublemaker was interested. I could have gone into more detail, but I think enough. We can leave it as is. We have 5 more minutes, so let me introduce you. So now we've completed originally what I intended to do. That is the letters that I published, the letter that Hachira didn't publish, and then David Eisen asked me to speak about the Meir Kahana letter. Then I was asked, and I shall do this, although I will not be here the next 2 weeks. I'll miss you all, but I'll not be here the next 2 weeks. 3 weeks, I'll be back in Eretz Hashem, and then we'll have a few classes in June, and then we'll break for the summer. Probably need 5 or 6, maybe even a little more, 7, 8, who knows? We never know. I do want to go look at not all the letters. That would be another 15 classes. But I look at some of the important letters in the Helfgott book. First one, a very interesting letter dealing with the Interfaith Chapel at with the Rav's view on Interfaith, the chapel at Cornell. I even got the pictures of it. And what that says, and then we'll move into some of the other letters. It's divided into sections, so I'll pick a couple letters from each section. What to do with foundlings, should the Jewish community be involved with this? Girls learning Gemara, the Rav's halachic approach, to round out the pictures of the Rav as a correspondent. So we will, and we'll see, we'll touch on some issues we haven't yet gotten to. There's only a couple, but we'll see a couple we haven't yet gotten to. So I will now take the questions and the comments. So Paul points out that the late lamented brilliant Israeli Oxford scholar, Dr. Isaiah Yishai Shachar, who I have to confess, Paul, I never heard of, who died in the mid-1980s at the early age of 42. His PhD thesis was on these images of the Jews suckling the pig. I did not know about that, but I would be not Oxford, London, you're saying. Okay, I'd be very annoyed if I go there and it's covered up. That's all I'm saying. Rabbi Yellen says, Ramosha was asked why he was seen to kiss. I think it was grandchildren. And he responded it was not during tefillah. I think also, look, at the end of the day, people have a Yetzer Hara. When the grandchildren come in, it's very hard not to give them a kiss. What are you going to do?
Can I take a few seconds to relate something to you?
Yes, hold on. Actually, go write it now. And then I was just going to cite you that Rav Yossi Fadowers often cite that comment to the Rav. Is that what you're going to talk about?
No, just something else you're going to find astonishing. Yeah. When I was a teenager in the early 60s, we used to go to the Amazon of Laurelton community in Southeast Queens. The Maradas was a man named Eli Romanek, nobody very famous, was a sort of fellow who functioned as a kind of an unofficial assistant rabbi. Nobody ever heard of an assistant rabbi in those days. But this guy functioned like one. Gave Shiurim, the gentlest, sweetest man you'll ever meet. That man was Meir Kahana. Go figure.
Okay, well, you know, you can have two sides. I spoke to him once. I guess you say he's gentle with Jews and not so gentle with others.
I think something got to him that just made him very upset, very angry.
Well, I mean, in New York in the 60s with the nonstop crime against Jewish communities.
And especially the Yoshino Brownsville. The Yoshino Brownsville was naked anti-Semitism.
Yeah,
you
so
also and you had the... You had the Black Panthers marching regularly outside shuls and demanding reparations, and this also triggered him quite a bit. I davened with him a number of times.
Yes, he mentions that. Shaul Magid mentions the Black Panthers and Black radicalism as an issue there. And I mean, that's I was a little surprised, but very impressed that Shaul Magid, knowing his politics, he lays it all out. And Black anti-Semitism was a big issue that Meir Kahana wrote about, and something that the mainstream community was afraid to touch. You had issues with the schools, the Jewish teachers. And the movement against Jewish teachers in the New York City school system. And again, the old elderly Jews who were left in areas and it wasn't safe. There's a lot to be said there. Now, someone privately texts me that the Rav did not sit with his son during davening and his grandchildren didn't daven with him. They went elsewhere. But I guess when even, I don't know, when his in this, the grandchildren probably what you're thinking of the Tversky's, they probably davened to the Tolner. But like when the Lichtensteins came, you have to ask for Moshe Lichtenstein. You could say we did a whole class. I'm sure some of you are friendly with him. We did a whole class on his letter. You can ask him when he came to Boston this summer, did he sit next to his father? But here we have Edut Ne'emana that he didn't sit with his son during davening, which Rabbi Kelman had mentioned that Rabbi Meir Kahana, incidentally, in Howard Beach, he originally, there wasn't a mechitza in that shul. There's a whole story as how he brought it in one night. He got his guys to come in and bring it in. There's a tshuva in Iras Moshe to Meir Kahana. Maybe two, but definitely one. The Bas Mitzvah tshuva. There's two Bas Mitzvah tshuvas in Iras Moshe. One of the Bas Mitzvah tshuvas in Iras Moshe from Ramosha Feinstein is addressed to, is sent to Rabbi Meir Kahana. So, you can read about him also in his early years. Rakefed, in his memoir, Kahana was the head of the Bnei Akiva chapter, the advisor, whatever they call it, that Rakefed was in. So that was also a different era. Rabbi Shudnow says, hard to believe.
Just to follow up on that. I heard Rabbi Rakefed say that when he put in the mechitza, apparently he got fired over that. He lost his job for putting in the mechitza overnight, if I remember correctly. And he said that had a huge impact on him. And a lot of this sort of radicalism, it made him sort of angry in a sense. So I don't know. I just remember hearing Rabbi Rakefed mention that. And he felt that that had a big impact on him, which, you know, maybe, you know, if a young person loses a job for putting in a pizza, and who knows? Anyways, okay, I'm sorry.
Hello, guys. I get why the young people who often don't think in a sophisticated fashion were very drawn to him. He gave, I knew someone who was a JDL person when I was in high school. They used to march. They were allowed to march, by the way, in the Israeli Day Parade, the JDL. And it was, Yossi Klein Halevi wrote about this. Rabbi Shudnow says that when he was Hillel director at University of Miami, or Meir Kahana was one of our speakers. I sat at the head table next to him. Before he went to Israel, and even after the early time when he went to Israel, but really before he started saying strongly provocative stuff about the Arabs in Israel, he was acceptable at all sorts of events in America. And even when he went to Israel for a while, he was. When he came to Brandeis, his views were all known, but he made it clear. He said, I'm not a racist. He says, I respect the Arabs. You don't respect the Arabs. I respect the Arabs because I know that they, just like if I was in their shoes, I'd be saying what they want. Namely, they're not going to be happy with the territories, the West Bank. They have pride. They want Tel Aviv. They want Haifa. And his attitude was, I respect them. I know what they want. Only a Jew who's proud, he says, can respect an Arab and understand what a proud Arab is. He would say, you liberal Jews, you don't respect them because you think they'll be satisfied with giving them a little bit of land. It shows you don't, you really have this like superiority complex. You think that they can be bought off. So that was his argument. He also, I heard him say this in person and also on tape, he said, he insisted when people said, you know, you want, I think he even says in the Brandeis talk, people say that, you know, you want to kick out the Arabs. He insisted, I will not throw one Arab out of Israel. He says, as soon as they wake up and hear that Meir Kahana is Rosh Memshala, they'll be running out and, they'll all be gone. So he said it with a smile, but, yes, so Rabbi Kelman points out that Rav Yaakov Herzog served as ambassador to Canada. We spoke a good deal about him, the Renaissance man that he was. I showed you how he published a commentary in English translation of Tractate Brachos. Paul says that Chaim Herzog was not orthodox in the current understanding, but he was meticulous in certain areas, in kashrut, including kashrut. My late wife, who worked in Beit Hanasi, was responsible for arranging kosher food for him on his overseas tours, including the UK, Buckingham Palace. That is very interesting, Paul. Thank you for calling that to our attention. I would have had no idea about this at all. They brought in kosher meat and chickens for him. Very nice. And he did study in Hebron. Chaim Herzog is one of the people that the Hebron Yeshiva can't take credit for because they don't want to take credit for people who didn't turn out the way they like. But that's I knew he was always very traditional, Masorati, and my sense is his son is as well.
My understanding is the current president, Ishmael Shabbat, he was in Ramaz. He, as you mentioned before, he did go to Ramaz. And one of his classmates is my son-in-law's aunt. And we were talking a few months ago. She remembers him very well from school in Ramaz. And I believe he is a Shomer Shabbat, as far as I know.
Yeah. Marty says that if you watch Yossi Cohen Halevi's autobiographical film, which I haven't, I've read a number of his writings, you'll see that he was very afraid of a new Holocaust growing up. And you, Marty, says you're waiting for someone to follow up on the Wall Street Journal's revelation a few weeks ago that Jeffrey Epstein arranged for a meeting between Ehud Barak and Noam Chomsky, a big anti-Semitic activist. Okay, not really relevant to what we're doing, but yes, I saw that also, and I can't figure out what that is about at all. Noam Chomsky is a big problem. His father was Zev Chomsky, Boston Hebrew College, a great Hebraist, everything good in what it meant to be a Jew. How Chomsky, I guess there's a lot, I'm sure there's a lot of Freudian stuff here, how the son was just the opposite. Avi says, are there any other letters we have from the Rav that are typed? Aren't they usually written in longhand? No, we have type letters as well. And we have typed letters, although the typed letters I have are typed up after the Rav wrote it, someone typed it up. I'm trying to think, we have some letters though. So for instance, since you ask, I will show you here in, so here for instance is, a letter that the Rav wrote, at the beginning of, Shirim Zechar Bamari. He had a letter there. It's actually a letter, I believe, to Tversky, thanking him for what he did in preparing the book, and then he signs it. And there aren't that many. They're very, very few, and only towards the end of his life. So it's a good question, but I don't think. What was the intention, Yannis says, of the forgers? I think the intention was so that Orthodox Jews can see that the Rav thought that Kahana was kosher. They weren't brazen enough to say that the Rav is a fan of Kahana, but saying that Kahana, there's some problems, but he's basically kosher. He's a Yerushalayim. We have to bring him close. Part of the community that koshers Kahana for Talmidim of the Rav, for modern Orthodoxy. If that would be successful, that I think would be a big achievement. Moshe Dayan was also saying that. Okay, I didn't know if it was today. Maybe Netanyahu would bring him in. It's things have changed. And finally, someone privately says that the Rav sat in his own shtender. This was the front on one side. This was in Dorchester as well as in Brookline. Yeah. So if you're remembering the Rav when his son is older. So the Rav is sitting in the front. But what about when his son was 10 years old? Rabbis who sit in the front with the shtender also have their young children. When their son's a teenager, you don't have an 18-year-old sitting up in the front of the shul with the father, the rabbi. But usually you'll have, let's say, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old. I wonder if when his son was before bar mitzvah, if he'd be sitting next to him. And also then I think you have to weigh things. On the one hand, the Rav speaks about solitude and all this. But on the other hand, there's also chinuch habonim. I would think that chinuch of your son overrides this idea of solitude. So maybe when your son is still young and you're teaching him, trying to make sure they're not talking and all that, then you sit next to them. But when your son's 18, 20, he doesn't need to sit next to you. I mean, I know it's nice. You always want to sit next to your father and shul. We think it's a very big deal. But then there's no real chinuch element anymore. It's just about an emotional tie and a connection. So that could be the difference. Thank you. Someone says Moshe Dayan said, don't get angry with the Arabs. He didn't say bow to their anger, but respect it. Yeah, you can listen to Kahana. He always said that I'm the only one who respects them because I take it seriously what they say. But the Rav, the Kitzer, to sum it up, the Rav thought the Kahana was a Chil Hashem. He thought he was a Chil Hashem. Now, you don't have to agree with this, and there's Talmidim, the Rav, who don't agree with it, but the Rav thought that this was a Chil Hashem, both because of what he was saying, but also because of how Jews how he was acting. The Jews are supposed to be level-headed, sophisticated, dignified, and not be rabble-rousers. That's the Rav's position. Others disagreed. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu went to Meir Kahana's funeral and had a very different view of him. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, thank you. So we'll see you in a few weeks. Please God, tomorrow, Dr. Sokolow and Moshe Shulman. And then because of Shavuos this week, of course, we only have a parshir in my Siddur class, but I will be giving, instead of my Siddur class on Friday morning, I'll give them Wednesday morning, 9:15, 15 minutes earlier, a class on Shavuot. So not to...
Okay, let me just say one thing, Rabbi Kelman, because I wanted... Someone asked, the question remains, what did the Rav feel when you received Herzog's letter? Oh. The okay. Shamashim, the family, no, he didn't receive the letter. They're right. They're pretty sure about that because he's never commented about it. No one knew about it. It seems that the letter was intercepted. So if you want to use that knowledge and figure out who was able to, Rakefet thinks it's like, he thinks he knows who it is, but he's not going to say, remember, the letter would have gone to YU. Different people had access to the Rav stuff. Look, the Rav's tapes disappeared. Lots of tapes of the Rav disappeared. So different people had access to it, but the Rav, he never received this letter, as best we can say. Okay.
Okay, thank you. All right, and I'm just going to finish up for the week. Mark Herman will be finishing his series on the Gaonim. That'll be Wednesday at 1 p.m. Okay, hope everybody's doing well, and okay, hope to learn with you soon. As always, please invite a friend to join us, and have a wonderful week. And enjoy the rest of the holiday, long weekend in Canada. Okay, fireworks, okay, if you want to go see. Anyways, enjoy. Laila Tov, everybody.
Chag Sameach to you.
I'm sorry?
Chag Sameach to you.
I'm going to call it a Chag Sameach, but okay.
It is Yontif this week, you know.
Yeah, it's almost Yontif. Okay. All right. Yeah. Very good. Okay, next week is
the
American.
Thank you very much.
So, anyways, okay. Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.